Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June the 6th, 1995. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Tom Perry, and he will be speaking on The Language Mosaic, Endangered Languages. Let's listen in.
My name is Tom Perry. I'm a linguist from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, BC. And this is a series called The Language Mosaic, and this session is the one about endangered languages. Before we get into the question of language endangerment, there's some general things that I want to bring up to think about language. I'm going to present the problem of endangered languages as a problem, and sometimes that's hard for speakers of English to grasp. That's because as speakers of English, we are really peculiar. We are peculiar in the way we can move around and the expectations that we have as speakers of English, as opposed to, say, some speaker of, well, let me pull out a language I know is very tiny, Kirikiri, which is spoken in Indonesia on the island of New Guinea, and as far as we know, has less than 200 speakers. Now, think for a minute about you and the language you speak. Is there anyone here who learned another language as their first language at home? So everybody here learned English from their parents. How about people who speak a second language? Who speaks a second language? Okay.
Sort of
will count. All right. Sort of. All right. Then who of those who say they sort of speak a second language, who has a real working knowledge of a second language? Can read...
read and speak with no understanding when it's heard.
How about the communities you're in? Think about those for a minute. Do any of you live in a community that has a significant second language minority where you could go to the Safeway and hear it spoken?
I've heard Spanish at Patrice.
How many of you live in a community where you would say there's no noticeable second language minority? Mm-hmm. You can see that really North America is very uniform in terms of the distribution of languages that people run into from day to day. There are many more languages in North America that are used, but they are sort of beneath public consciousness because we don't have to deal with them. We could talk for a long time on things like attitudes towards language and how people react to hearing people speak some other language in their own Safeway, for example, or something like that. that's an example I have heard described, that I was in my own Safeway and there were people speaking Spanish there, and you'd think that in the United States, if they were going to be in the Safeway, they'd speak English. And there are reflections of attitudes of all kinds that you hear in those sorts of things. What I want to do is borrow a page from Chuck Huff here and talk a little bit about some fallacies that we have that speakers of English in particular fall into very readily. One is one I call the monolingual fallacy. Because I only speak one language, everybody else does. In truth, most of the world speaks more than one language. Sometimes three or four. And we think of countries like China, for example, as being these monolithic places where everyone speaks Mandarin. This isn't true. There are parts of China where you can find communities of a million or more who speak something else entirely. It's not even related to Chinese. The Chinese government doesn't think much of them, doesn't put much resources in those areas and so forth, but they have existed there for thousands of years. So that this notion of thinking in very broad or monolithic terms about language is not accurate as far as the way the world actually works. A second fallacy I call a nationality fallacy, and that's that national borders actually define the distribution of languages. Like that example I gave about the Safeway. Well, if you're in the United States, you ought to speak English. That sort of reasoning really doesn't work because languages are spread out all over the place. English is a good example. It transcends national borders. It's one of the really big international languages. That there is a kind of a perception that, well, national borders ought to define where languages are spoken. I don't know whether this is our compulsion for tidiness or what, but for some reason we have this idea that political borders must align somehow with linguistic borders. But the sort of classic case is Europe, where you can find someone in a village a few miles inside of Germany on the Dutch border who can go 5-6 miles into Holland and have a perfectly good conversation with the people over there who say they speak Dutch. Yet he could go to Bavaria and not be understood at all. Yet both of the Bavarian and the fellow from northwestern Germany would claim they speak German. What they speak, of course, is a local language which has this political veneer, if you want, on it that gives it a label. We often deal in introductory linguistics courses with trying to explain the difference between a language and a dialect. And it gets very confusing. And the one definition that seems to work best for me is that, well, if you want, you can think of a language as a dialect with an army. It doesn't matter whether you call different varieties of speech dialects or languages. What matters is that they are distinct. And sometimes different varieties of the same language, according to some political definition, are in fact distinct, and they can't carry on a conversation between two speakers of those two varieties. So the third fallacy I wanted to go through quickly is what I call the language equivalence fallacy, that one language is just as good as another. There is a sense in which this is true. That is, that there are no languages which are inherently better than others, say, for being lovers or economics or whatever. However, for a particular culture, the language question may be crucial. If you ask a religious Jew, for example, how crucial Hebrew is to that culture, what would he say?
Essential.
Indispensable, right? You can't read the Torah without it. So in that sense, in a cultural sense, languages are not just as good as any other. That for the people who use them, they may be critical. We are less attached to the language English than many cultures around the world are attached to their own language. Yeah.
Doesn't language lose a lot in translation, too?
Yes, it does. And that may be part of why things are so crucial culturally, that as soon as you begin to translate, you feel that something is being diluted or you aren't close to the roots of the culture that you're concerned with. I just wanted to bring those fallacies out because they often lurk in the background when we start thinking about other languages. And it's important to look at the situation that a language is used in. we have it easy in that if you think of different purposes for language, education, commerce, international travel, things like that, English is pretty useful in many different areas. And so we don't think about all of these things. But if you're a young business person in Asia somewhere, you have to be concerned about not only speaking, so suppose you're Thai, not only speaking Thai, but English and Mandarin. Those are things you have to think about. And I want to say at the outset, knowing or not knowing a given language isn't good or bad. People decide what language they need to use based on their needs for communication. And it's a choice, like whether to study math or learn diesel engine maintenance or something like that. And the important, I think the operative word here is a choice. We happen to have a choice in North America that's fairly easy. English is pretty all-purpose. So it's easy to choose, well, I'll just stick with English. It seems to work for me. Now, before we get into talking about languages, there are some cultural background that I think is it's important to understand the status of particular languages. How many of you live in the same house that you lived in when you were born? Anybody? Not many people in North America could claim that. And in many parts of the world, that's still true. We are very mobile. And our culture has been universalized. Kind of like it doesn't matter where we are, we can take it all with us. We can pack everything up and take it with us. So there are a number of features of the kind of culture we live in a modern industrial society, and particularly a North American one, that I call we have made culture modular. It's made up of different components, in fact, that we can pick and choose and decide, well, for example, I decide not to use English. I could go somewhere where they speak French, Quebec, perhaps. There are very few people who actually make a life choice based on which language they use in a particular place. More often than not, it goes the other way. You get a job somewhere and you have to learn the local language. For example, if you're in business and they give you the territory of all of South America, then you're well advised to learn Spanish. In a modular culture, we live, in a sense, detached from the environment. We make our own environments. People have observed and noticed that cities are rather peculiar environments, but we make them nevertheless, you know. They're not wildernesses, but they're still wild, you know. They have these strange characteristics. Our culture is very individualistic, right? We can pack up and move as individuals. We don't have to cart granny and the next generation everything with us. We sort of pull ourselves out of family groupings and we can go. We have a concept of exclusive land ownership. We go off somewhere and we buy ourselves a house or a piece of ground somewhere. There's no question of, well, can I get a place to stay? Well, you look up in the real estate directory, so what's on sale? Our education is institutional, right? Come 6 years of age, we're carted off to this big machine that is all set up to hand out education in some form or another. And a lot of that is, again, picking and choosing, right? We want to take something from Greek thought, and we want to get some modern industrial chemistry, and it's all put together of different sources. We read the history of Europe, even though we're not particularly interested in Europe. And then we end up with what I would call mixed cultural values. If you look at the array or the variety of cultural values that people have. You know, there are the folks who like to sit in front of the TV all the time with a Coke or a beer or something, and they think that's high culture. Others who wouldn't be caught dead, don't own a TV, and only go to operas. We have this broad range of cultural values of where we get our entertainment, where what we think is important, and what sort of things we like to preserve and work for. We have zillions of interest groups, right? You can join Friends of the Opera, the Sierra Club, all those different things that let you express your cultural values. And you have this smorgasbord of choices. And I want to contrast that to what I call holistic cultures that don't work that way at all. And holistic cultures were, for example, the way Native American cultures were when we came here to this continent. They're the way that a large number of the existing ethnic groups around the world still operate, even some that are fairly modernized. And I'm going to think of you can think of this in terms of a continuum from a very modular culture to a very holistic one. Holistic cultures, very often they are very the culture and the environment are very interdependent. You read or you hear myths, they're about particular places. The explanations and the science are about particular phenomena that are very local. It's very locally adapted sort of cultural interpretation of what's going on. They're very communal in the sense that perhaps they don't own land, that they just live on the land and it's all there for people to use as they need. And there's this notion of the commons that used to exist in England, that there's a lot of common land that was out there for people to hunt on or whatever, and no one would take too much, and everything would stay pretty much in balance. And that's very, very true of the native cultures around here. That's the way they worked. The fisheries that they had were there for everybody. They all lined up to do their fishing in the fall, and there'd be 2,000 or 3,000 fishermen around one particularly good spot, and everyone would assume, yes, everyone can be here. There's no reason why we have to, you know, put a fence around it and call it ours. They have a sense, instead of owning land, that they belong to the land. That is, that they wouldn't even think of packing up and moving. In fact, it's very disrupting when this happened to them. If you look at the native history around here, when they were moved off to reservations, it began to disrupt their way of life totally. They have traditional education rather than institutional. You learn the traditions, the stories that come down from generation to generation. Very often it was a family-based kind of education where a grandparent would know all the stories and be sure that they were passed on. They end up this way with very coherent cultural values. Their entertainment and their religion and their stories of who they are and everything are all interwoven. You know, you don't sit down and say, well, I feel like reading a play tonight. I think I'll choose a Greek one. You only have certain ones that you know in a holistic culture. And their spirituality is completely integrated with that. So their stories and their beliefs are all intertwined, and you don't learn about the religion without learning the stories. Okay, that's some cultural background. Let's take a look at how that works in terms of languages. If you look at the landscape of languages around the world, there are approximately 6,000 of them that have been cataloged. And by catalog means that literally there's a line in a catalog somewhere that we know this language exists and it's different from the one down the river. About 4,000 of them are languages that anybody knows more than that about. And you can imagine that for that many different languages, knowing that some of them are huge, like Mandarin and English, some of them must be very small. And in fact, they are. I'm going to talk later, or at least perhaps tomorrow, about some of these facts about very tiny languages and what is going on with them and why we should be interested in them at all. Naturally, if you look at the languages that are used in these kind of holistic cultures that I was talking about, which are very quickly becoming old-fashioned and outmoded sorts of ways of living, they have a number of properties that go along with that sort of organization. First of all, they're primarily spoken. Most of the languages in the world, most of them, keep in mind, most of them are not yet written, or at least do not have a broad base of literacy in that language. They may be written by people who don't speak them, like linguists. They are, as in holistic cultures, it is the language that is the carrier of the education. So that if you stop speaking the language, you stop learning the stories. You stop learning the stories, the culture disappears. This is not true in our modern modular culture, because we have modularized everything, and so we have libraries. We stuff it all away in the library. There's anything you want to find out that ever happened that anybody thought was important enough to write down is to be found somewhere. And people like us academics are trained to go root that stuff out and bring it out into the light, so that people can either say, oh, that's interesting, or ho-hum. And speakers of local languages always have a particular sense of place and time. It's interesting to hear them talk about their place in time, in fact, as in generations, just being another step in a long story. We don't seem to have that sense of place and time. We're always sort of here and now. And the creative aspect of culture in these sorts of holistic cultures is very spontaneous. Right? You don't go to the library and get a novel. Right? We're very organized. We almost have premeditated cultural events, you know, that everything is planned. You can decide to write a novel and you write it down and so forth. In this spontaneous sort of cultural thing, you know, you just do the dance, or you sing the song, or if need be, you make one up. It's all real time and on the fly. And consequently, it's very difficult to keep recorded except in the memory of people. And so if you take away the people, or you take away the medium in which they store this information, which is very often the language, then it's gone. Recipes, for example. Some of the most interesting stuff I've gotten in terms of listening to native people is recipes. Things they don't remember how to do anymore. But some older people will remember, this is the way we cooked this, or this is what we used to eat. And that stuff is interesting. And in the recipes, particularly in the rainforest peoples, you begin to find out things that science doesn't even know. Because they've had thousands of years to find out that this particular plant, if you squeeze the juice out of it, kills bugs. And it may be a plant that the scientists haven't even gotten around to cataloging yet. So, contrast those kind of languages, which I'm just going to call with a blanket term local languages. They grow up in a particular place, and you even have a local language. If you spoke a particular accent of English when you were a kid, if you're from the South or something, you can call that your local language. But that's not the language you use in certain contexts where you don't want to be known as from that place. Right? You can still go back and speak your local language, but you shift to a different kind of English to go to the bank or to go give a lecture at your college or whatever. But local languages, I contrast to what the bigger languages are the ones I call literacy languages. The ones that are written and attached in some way to modular cultures, those modern creations. And the plain fact about what's going on in the world right now is that literacy languages are driving out local languages. Because for a whole host of reasons, literacy is cool. It's useful. Yeah?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Your statement just now, literacy languages, say that again.
Are driving out local languages. They're displacing them.
Okay. Well, so then are you saying unless like native languages are written down? Is that what you're saying?
That's part of what I'm saying, yeah.
Okay.
Native people themselves are resorting to...
Hiring linguists.
Are resorting to actually teaching reading and writing of their language.
That's what's happening in our locality.
Uh-huh.
Which is where?
By the Oneida Reservation.
Yeah.
It's one of in East. Wisconsin. Yeah, eastern Wisconsin. And it's mainly because of the Oneida Nation now has really become very wealthy because of gaming.
Right.
And instead of giving all their people, handouts, they're investing in their people, in their culture, and so that's been very interesting.
Yeah, when I get around to the topic of language rescue, that's one aspect of what I want to talk about, the ways that literacy is coming around to in aid not only of the language but also the people.
Because it was almost dead. Mm-hmm. It was almost dead, and now they have through linguists have written down mm-hmm. now.
That's basically my business too.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of work to be done in that regard, and there is a big question of whether it's worth all the effort. Clearly, to the Oneidas and to the people I work with, the Shuswap and the Ballikulas in British Columbia, it's worth it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, having gone through all that cultural background stuff and getting these terms, local language versus a literacy language, let's go on and look at what I call the problem. Why is it a problem that these languages are disappearing? As was pointed out, many of the Native American languages are either dead or on the verge of it. In fact, of the 6,000 languages estimated to exist in the world, at the present rates of disappearance, there may be only 600 of them left by the year 2100. There will be a large number, 600 or so, of languages that come from the class of powerful languages, the ones like English, Arabic, Mandarin, a number of those. They are all entrenched literacy languages. That is, they are used in school systems, they are probably national languages, they have a particular status in commerce, and they have a reason for living in a certain sense that comes from not so much tradition but from a usefulness in a modular culture. Our modular cultures require mobility and literacy, those two things. And languages that have been adapted to that are more likely to survive. The rest of them are already threatened, and I'm including their some very large groups. I talked a couple of years ago with a professor from the Beijing Institute of Nationalities, which is a minority university in Beijing. And he was a professor of linguistics, and he was a speaker, a native speaker, a representative of a group in southern China who speak a Thai language, a language related to Thai. It has over 1 million speakers. And he flatly told me, my language is endangered. I said, well, you have 1 million speakers. He says, but in the face of 900 million speakers of Han Chinese, we are a fly on the wall, so to speak, a little speck. So that issue can be relative as to what it takes to be a viable language. And one of the things that linguists are beginning to do is to devise viability studies for people who want to know. The question is not, can we preserve all the languages in the world? That's going to be difficult to even talk about. That's impossible. I think the relevant question to ask is that people who choose to preserve their language, are they going to be able to? And in the case of the Oneida Nation and many other native peoples, they have made a choice. And they're fortunate in having the resources to try to do something about it.
But it's really difficult because they don't speak it. I mean, there are so few speakers at the present time.
Well, one group that I worked with that has a very active program now essentially had a stroke of luck. In the early part of the century, many of their children were just simply removed from homes and sent away to boarding schools.
That's what happened to the United also.
One woman, or one girl of about 7, was sent off to school, and the school said, she's too sickly, and they sent her home. She was the last person in her people to get a traditional education. She spent the last 25 years of her life as what they call the professor of the shoe swap. They sat her in front of video cameras, and they made tape recordings. She tried to teach them everything she had ever learned. Yes, question.
In Peru, it's just kind of the opposite. I went down with Wycliffe translators, and for over 500 years, the Spanish have tried to stamp out the Inca language.
Yeah.
Well, today, there's more Peruvians that speak the Inca language than Spanish, and the Inca was language of the whole west coast of South America. And so they finally went to a bilingual school system and hired Wycliffe to translate the language and put it in a written poem, because they recognized that the people that spoke that language had a lot to contribute, and education was a necessary part of language.
That's an interesting point. Quechua is one of the 600 that will survive. That's the language of the Incas. And it is entrenched in this way already in the school systems and so forth. But the interesting thing is that both the Mayan languages and the language of the Incas were themselves colonial languages. Uh-huh. And they probably were responsible for snuffing out hundreds of different languages in Central and South America through their own empires before the Spanish ever got there.
But didn't the Incas, when they conquered the nation, they made them speak, was it Quechua?
Yeah. Well, they used, that's what it's called nowadays, yeah.
They made them learn Quechua, but they let them keep their own language.
Well, that's, and that, while that is typical of most of the world, where you usually have either a colonial or a national language on top of your local language. The other thing that they did was that, particularly obstreperous groups, they would simply disperse or do in or something else, which effectively killed the language. There are many ways to kill a language, but and just commanding someone not to speak it anymore is not used that often. It's a natural effect of colonial occupations, usually. Well. So the problem, I see three aspects of the problem in terms of what is it we're going to lose when we lose all those languages. Well, obviously one of the things we're going to lose is an enormous amount of cultural diversity. cultural diversity begins to disappear as soon as you get into real modular culture. You get bits and pieces from all over the place, but you don't have good ethnic neighborhoods anymore where you can go for, you got three blocks over here it's got two Afghan restaurants in it, three blocks over here that you got another kind. That kind of real diversity that where people have a clear identity begins to evaporate. Question up there, Ned.
I don't know if that comes with a footnote that says ethnocentric also.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Double check.
Yeah. We get a notion that we have some very clear ethnic culture, when in fact what we have is kind of an amalgam. Mm-hmm. And then we say, this is the one we all want to follow. We can get into all, discussions of how we live in diversity and celebrate diversity, and it's a very hard thing to do, particularly when it gets mixed up with politics and educational issues and a number of other things.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is language like oil that cannot be replaced? Would there ever be a birth of a language?
Yes, there are. English, modern English as we know it, was born out of a combination of Norman French and Anglo-Saxon. English is really a French Creole. There are a lot of scholars, historians of English who don't like that characterization, but it's accurate. Anytime that there is a mixing of languages, that happens. There's one Creole that's a national language. It's the language of Papua New Guinea, Tok Pisin. If you ask in New Guinea, or in Papua New Guinea, to speak English, that's what they speak. Australians speak European, which is what they call the English that everybody else speaks. Australians just think that's hilarious, that they go to Papua New Guinea and get told they speak European. So diversity is one casualty of losing all these cultures, because many of these languages that we're talking about that are disappearing are also bearers or carriers, vessels in which the cultures they represent are contained. Yeah.
I don't mean to be obstreperous, but I'm interested in why we ought to value diversity.
Aha.
It's too long a conversation to have tonight.
No,
okay.
Let me go on to a couple of my other reasons.
Okay.
All right, which in fact do address that question.
Okay.
One of them is what we have been talking about lately, is intellectual wealth. Shakespeare is one way to write plays. The French have a different dramatic tradition. The people from Africa have yet another. And if you want to talk about dramatic traditions, for example, if all of these disappear, and we've never even examined these, a good percentage of them for such things as dramatic tradition, we'll never know what they were like. And so we won't know anything about the range of intellectual wealth that we as humans possess, because some of it's gone. A linguist who's a leading figure in this area has made a very well put statement on this. It says, it seems to me reasonable to hold that a principal human purpose is the fullest possible use of the human mind in creating intellectual wealth. Linguistic and cultural diversity is an enabling condition for the fullest achievement of this purpose. Since it is diversity which permits the fullest exploration of the paths of creation. A mere glance around the world tells us this. It's speaking to linguists, we all agree. We all nod our head when he says this. Thus, the loss of a language is a certain tragedy for the human purpose. So he's putting it on the scale of a question for all of humankind. You know, should we really lose what it is these people know and do? The other area is perhaps more satisfying for the empiricist in you. And that's the question of understanding. It's an anthropological question, basically, but it's more than that, really. For linguists, anyway, it's a very critical thing. It's, how are we going to understand this human faculty of language if we lose some of our evidence, basically? There's one very, very telling example that I can give that comes from some of the research that's gone on the last few years. There are four languages among the various indigenous languages of the island of Formosa: Kanakanabu, Sarua, Rukai, and So. The four of them have, between them, 11,000 speakers. Now, why should anybody care about these little hill languages in Formosa, which are about to be inundated by Mandarin? As it turns out, in terms of the ethnic history of the entire Pacific region, they belong to a family of languages we call Austronesian. It's an enormous family of languages, comprising almost 2,000 languages, or a third of the total of languages in the world. There are four branches to the Austronesian family, and these four languages in Formosa each are in a separate branch. This suggests one thing to us, that this might be where they all started. This is made even stronger by the fact that all of the other 1,996 languages in this family exist outside of Formosa and are related to only one of these. So it's only one of these peoples who got in their canoes and paddled off into the sunset. They are, in a sense, the ancestors of all those speakers of Austronesia, all the way down to Maori, all the way over to Hawaiian, all the way over to the Indian Ocean. That's an enormous thing, and it creates an enormous anthropological issue of how did the South Pacific get populated? Well, there are a couple of current theories, but the one that seems strongest from the linguist point of view is the one that, well, it all started in Formosa and they headed south. All of the languages in the Philippines, all of Indonesia, well, not all of Indonesia, some of Indonesia, all those are Austronesian languages in one form or another. So that's the kind of question of understanding that we're missing if we see all these languages disappear. And I'm not even touching on all the anthropological understanding that disappears when their cultures disappear. And to some extent, even the scientific understanding. To give you an idea of what a problem biodiversity is for modern science, in Papua New Guinea, entomologists went in there to study insects. And they decided to do a sampling of 45 trees. And what they did was they spread out these plastic tarps under a particular tree, and then they zapped it. They put an insecticide in the tree and watched what fell out on the ground. And what baffled them and boggled their minds was that every time they'd move from one tree to another, 60% of the species would be entirely new. They weren't even on the last tree, let alone in the books. Most of those were weevils of one kind or another, but never mind. Imagine the kind of diversity and the localization that goes on there. Well, if you have people who have been living in the same place for 4,000 or 5,000 years, they learn which bugs are good to eat, and they can tell you an enormously amount more than you can find out trying to catalog all this stuff and then figure out what to do with it. A lot of the very successful things that have been done with indigenous peoples have been ethnobotany. You know, tell us about your plants. What do you use them for? They discovered drugs that way. We're doing that here in the Northwest now. We have these ethnobotanical projects. There are a lot of people from the botany departments want to go out and talk to native people and find out what the plants are used for. I found out just in passing once why the Tsimshian people of Southeast Alaska claim they never had head lice till the missionaries came. Well, they used to make their own hair oil, and they used the juice of the hellebore root in the recipe. Well, hellebore is a natural insecticide. So they wore this stuff, and they put it in ulican grease, which is a smelt oil. It's a fish oil. And the missionaries came and said, "Ooh, you stink. Stop wearing that hair oil." And then they got head lice. So the loss of traditional knowledge like this is probably something that even scientists should worry about. Yeah.
In another area, the Oneida tribe is an unusual tribe because it was matriarchal. And the language tells us a lot about the structure of that society. And if either now or at some point in the future, we would be interested in learning about the or if women take a different role in our society, for example, our knowledge of that language would be helpful to us in knowing how a society here operated with that was definitely matriarchal.
Well, I find that we tend to cast our own ethnocentric views on the organization of Native peoples, you know, and we see, for example, that most Native groups in North America have chief hierarchies. And we immediately think organization chart like in a corporation. You know, you got the big chief, you got the vice chiefs, and you know, all that kind of thing. It doesn't really work that way. And we also look at it and we think, even some that are not so obviously matriarchal, we think that, oh, well, they're all male-dominated. That's not true either. The Iroquois Confederacy has a council of 50 chiefs, and they're all men. However, they're all elected by women.
That's right, the elders.
The elder women are the electors. And when the chief dies, there's some grandmother they go to and say, "Who should we take next as chief?" And she says, "Go get that guy." So that it's not the kind of organization that we are accustomed to. And the whole business of the authority of chiefs is not chain of command sort of thing that we're used to. It's very much negotiated. A lot of chief hierarchies are based on arranged marriages and cousins and, you know, clan relationships. And you don't just, you know, order your cousin to come over and fight a war with you. You got to persuade him to. Even though from the outside and from the view of white settlers and so forth, it looked like that guy's the big chief. Their societies did not work the way we expected them to.
And if we record dying languages and catalog them today, they might answer today's questions. But once that language has died, the answers to tomorrow's questions might not be available.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that I lived quite a while up in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. You said something about boarding schools, and they only have a few grade schools up there, so the kids are sent to Mount Edgecombe and Sitka. Mm-hmm. And guess who teaches them? The people from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they're all white.
Yeah.
And they teach them English and all that. And the kids go back. I can remember when I went to church, we'd be singing a hymn in English, reading it, and the Eskimos would be singing the same hymn, but they could translate our English into their language. And all these missionaries for years were trying to put it down in print and never made it.
Yeah.
Now the language is dying out, but the kids don't want to speak it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, that's the kind of model that existed all throughout the settlement of the West, and it's had that result everywhere. I've talked to elders who, when they were in school as children, had their mouths taped shut for speaking their language. And the punishment was for all day, which meant you also couldn't eat. Well, let me give you an idea of some of the dimensions of the problem. I mentioned that about the 6,000 languages where we only expect that maybe 600 are viable enough to be living by the year 2100. Of those 600 that are probably remain, at most there will be about 20 families of languages. Of course, two of the biggest ones right off will be the European ones and the Chinese ones. European has two of the biggest languages, global languages, Spanish and English. About half of all the languages, the 600 that remain, will belong to just two families, the European family. And in terms of numbers of different languages, not speakers, the Niger-Congo family from Africa, the one that Swahili is in, and all of the national languages of African countries. That's a pretty catastrophic loss of diversity there. And it doesn't address some of the details of what kinds of languages are actually going to be lost. Because without a doubt, the most unexplored and numerous languages are the kind you find in the jungles of Peru or in the Amazon basin or in Papua New Guinea, which are still what we would call very primitive societies, hunter-gatherer societies. The very interesting thing that's been discovered over the history ethnic history and technological history, really, is the effect of the development of agriculture has been to homogenize linguistic landscapes. The places where we find enormous linguistic diversity are still not largely agricultural. And it's very interesting that Europe is perhaps the really interesting case because the history of Europe has been so intensely studied, the prehistory of Europe. We know that the ancestors of all the Europeans started out somewhere, perhaps in Asia Minor. They migrated very, very slowly into Europe. The migration was slow because the evidence is that they'd already developed agriculture. The effect of what they did was to probably obliterate all of the existing languages in Europe that weren't European, except for perhaps two. Basque is the one little remnant of some language that is not European, that still is to be found in Europe. Probably also the Lapps were in Lapland still at that time. They're not European. And it's interesting that later their cousins from further east moved into the eastern part of Europe, Finnish, Estonian, and some of those. So that's very interesting that agriculture seems to have this effect. We guess that at the time agriculture seems to have been invented, maybe 6,000 or 8,000 years ago, that there were twice as many languages. There are probably 12,000 around the world. So we've already lost that many. And this, what this means is that the scale of language, it seems to be sensitive to things like technology and economic factors. And so as those things accelerate and become more universalized, we can expect this effect to be accelerated. And the places where people have lived undisturbed for thousands of years are where you can still find probably the way the landscape used to be in terms of cultures and languages. And it's a very eerie sort of proposition. to go into these places and realize that you're probably stepping back thousands of years. And you wonder, you know, what is the effect going to be when, you know, the rest of the world begins to impinge on these places. And I'm not suggesting we build fences around them and keep them from having any contact. They're, actually, what I want to talk about tomorrow is, what do we do? What do we do? I don't want to get to my transparency tonight because it's got too much stuff on it to deal with tonight, but I will start with that tomorrow when we start talking about rescuing language, rescuing languages, and we'll take a look at some of the characteristics or the distribution of languages and how they're spread around, and then look at the size of the problem. It's really enormous. As we linguists tell people, you know, the vineyards are many and the workers are few here. Question?
I want to do a thought experiment.
A thought experiment, okay.
You said that there are some linguists who have been working out the viability indexes, which I'm assuming means that you can figure out how difficult it would be to keep a language around.
Yeah.
But that's part of viability.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me like one variable in a cost-benefit analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to get the benefit variable? I mean, we talked some about what the benefit of diversity is.
Mm-hmm.
But is it possible? And I'm thinking if we have this problem of if what we have to do is language triage, can you say it's more important to save one than another because the benefit is likely to be larger?
I think
by
that
saving this one than the
answer to that for me is that the benefit has to be defined by the people who use it.
Mm-hmm.
So they self-select in a certain sense. And there are some groups who will not lift a finger and who could care less. I mean, that's surprising to hear, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. But that also leaves some things up to the luck of the draw, to make a bad pun, the Oneida.
Yeah. It does.
Because, I mean, it's certainly possible to begin caring about your language now that you have enough money to care.
I think that there are some things to say about how resources for literacy are applied.
Well, I think, though, the linguists have been working on the Oneida language for 20 years. It's not like...
Yeah.
This is not just since they've gotten the money to do it. For the last 20 years, they've been seeking out linguists to write down their language because they knew that it was going to die.
Once that primary work is done, the trick and the expense is to getting it into the schools.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
They have their own tribal school now, and they're trying to do as much native language as they can.
Yeah.
But it's slow.
Yeah, but as I said, applying literacy resources is one issue. Should UNESCO, for example, be spending money to continue to propagate Indonesian in a way that stamps out hundreds of different languages? Or should they be using their money to, start early literacy programs in local languages? And that's a subject that gets into my language rescue.
Well, that's why I was asking the question about how one measured the benefit of one.